Hey, I'm Brett Podolsky, co-founder of The Farmer's Dog. We make fresh food for dogs. We started the company when we saw what a huge difference it made in my own dog, Jada, when she stopped eating ultra-processed kibble and started eating fresh, whole food. The Farmer's Dog food isn't fancy. It's just real food delivered to your door in pre-portioned packs. It's better for them and easier for you.
Get 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/podcast. That's thefarmersdog.com/podcast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and we're powered today once again by Geico. And guess what we're doing today? Celebrating 40 years of Anthrax with the core lineup. 40 years, that's so amazing. Guitarist Scott Ian, Charlie Benanti, of course, my good friend. All these guys are my good friends. Frank Bello on bass, singer Joey Belladonna. This monumentous occasion is being brought to you today by one killer sponsor for this one killer band. I'm talking about our fellow rock and roll fans, Geico. And you know, Geico is going to be the first in at the Anthrax 40 live streaming event this Friday, July 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your tickets and see the special show at anthraxlive.com. And if you haven't seen the Anthrax 40 documentary series, you can check it out on Anthrax YouTube channel. 22 episodes. We talk about some of that stuff that the doc covers. It's coming up on this show. The documentary is amazing. Split up into 22 different episodes, like we said. We also hit on some of the incredible, pioneering, groundbreaking highlights from the band's 40 years. The big four shows, their appearance on Married with Children, traveling on Iron Maiden's private plane flown by Bruce Dickinson, the making of the Among the Living and Spreading the Disease records, and Joey Belladonna joining the band. We'll get into the infamous Roseland Ballroom gig that landed Anthrax their first major label deal, along with Metallica and Raven. We'll talk about Scott Ian shaving his head and Charlie cutting off his hair in a time where heavy metal was synonymous with long hair. Anthrax was the first to do that. Of course, the first to wear board shorts on stage, the first to incorporate rap and metal together. So many pioneering moments in Anthrax's 40-year career. Unbelievable that they've been 40 years together so far. We're going to celebrate that with Scott, Charlie, Frank, and Joey, the 40 years of Anthrax, starting now on Talk is Jericho, thanks to Geico. Let's just go right into it. So this is pretty crazy that we're talking about the 40th anniversary of Anthrax. That's got to be in the top 1% to even get to 40 years. And here you guys are as a band, one of those rare occasions when you could possibly be bigger now than you've ever been. First off, does it seem like 40 years or 38 years or 36 years, depending on who we're talking to here?
Only when I see my doctor, it feels like 40 years.
I just came from physical therapy, literally. I've got tennis elbow, which is the worst name for a right-hand thrash metal playing guitar injury. And they well, you've got tennis elbow. I'm like, can't we call it something else?
Thrash elbow or something.
I'm not lying. I just came back. I just got a cortisone injection right in my shoulder. So this song's kind of like
Chris is great. 40 years in, it's great, dude. It's going well.
This is like Jaws. Let's discuss all of our rock and roll injuries. I chipped a tooth once on the mic stand.
Hold on, I got one right. It's all that. Man. It's crazy, but yeah, this is what happens in your 40th year. You talk about your doctors and how I can stay on tour. It's wonderful.
Doing these interviews and stuff like that, it brings you back. And I mean, it's not exactly 40 yet, but thinking about all the stuff that we've done, you start to put it into years, and it's like, yeah, it's been that long.
Yeah. When obviously I've been doing a lot of going through boxes and bins and looking for photos and just going through old stuff. And so, you know, kind of taking that trip down memory lane, which is something I don't often do, because, you know, we're always busy. We're always working. We're always moving forward. Again, another shark reference, but getting to spend the time and working on this doc series that we've been running leading up to the actual anniversary, it's been great. You know, I look back at old photos and it does feel like, oh my God, like that. It's like lifetimes ago when I look back at some of the stuff.
Are you guys doing that also when I've seen some of these videos for the first time in quite a long time? Is it like bringing back all that time and you kind of live it again? It's like, man, that was such a good time. I wish we had more of that. It's so just hanging out things we had. And I'm looking, and it's been a great ride just seeing these things. It's like, wow, we had a great time. I'm just saying this as a fan, and we were the guys. We were the guys in it. It really feels from the heart. It's a great ride.
Yeah, I agree. I've talked more about Ithaca, New York in the past few weeks than I did when I was in Ithaca for 6 months.
Joey, our friends at Geico want to know, what do you think back to when you think about all these years?
Well, you know, there's a lot of great things that we've done, and all the people that have been like so influenced. I'm really, really happy to hear a lot of that, because it makes you feel like you've actually done more than you even know of, you know, and how you've really made an influence and an impact on a lot of musicians that you would never think that even had any kind of influence on you or even knew about you that much at all. And obviously all these reminiscings that we got going on, it makes you really, really understand that it's been quite a while, you know? So yeah, it's definitely awesome. You know, it's great.
I just had my 30th year anniversary in wrestling about 6 months ago in October.
Congrats, man. That's awesome.
Thanks, dude. But just to hear all the people that you influence coming out of the, coming out and saying all these nice words, does that blow your mind a bit? Cause I've been watching the documentary. I wait every day. I refresh. Oh, the new one's up. And you got this cast of characters that are the who's who in so many different realms, all saying how much they love Anthrax and how influenced they are by your band. Is that something that when you hear it and see it, does it make you go like, holy shit, we really did do something cool here?
It's funny. I was watching the edit of the one that's up today, the episode 9, and it's got lots of people saying wonderful things about Among the Living. And I got scared for a second thinking like, I hope this doesn't come off like we're just being like, look at all these, we're just putting all this stuff, the people saying nice things about us. Like, who the fuck do we think we are? You know? And I asked Pearl, I said, is this coming off weird? And she's like, no, it's your 40th. This is what, like, this, you should have even more. Like, it's amazing. And I do feel that way. And I have to point out specifically, I had no idea that all these years that Henry Rollins was actually such a fan.
And yeah. That's the one that got me.
And I've been paying such close attention.
Yeah.
Like, I've known Henry for a long time. I never once assumed he was a fan of our band, but we've been friends and he's always been super cool. And, but I never, he's probably not into, you know, what we do, and we never talk about it. But, then to see he's got all this very like deep and thoughtful stuff to say yeah. about the first three records, I was like, "Well, he's actually was really paying attention back then."
The thing is, I think like for us, and I think other guys and bands will understand it too. Like when you're making a record, you feel like, "Oh, I think this is really good. This is really good." But it's only until it comes out and then other people tell you how good it is, that's how you measure it. So when I hear people talking about us in this way, I'm getting kind of like embarrassed and I'm blushing because it's like, wow, I never knew. So now whoever said all these great things, next time I see them, I'm just going to just smile at them. Like, yeah. Yeah.
It's almost like, you know, it's almost like you're watching like In Memoriam. I'm like, are we dead? You know, it's one of those things, but it feels so good.
No, but actually, we've accomplished a lot of stuff. I mean, we're actually pretty good, you know. What we've done is real. I mean, we still have a lot to offer people, and I think people appreciate what we've done, and it makes you feel good about it. You know, it's all you can.
I mean, let's just be fucking honest. We fucking rule. Among the Living is the fucking best thrash record ever made, and everyone shut the fuck up.
Dude, that's going to be used so many places. That little sentence right there.
There's your blabbermouth clickbait right there.
If you don't, you know what? You know how hard I'm getting into wrestling now. You know how hard it is to make 40 years? It's because we fucking rule.
But let's talk a little bit about kind of the form of music that you helped pioneer. Talking about thrash metal, and it's interesting because when you watch back and see, you know, the documentary that we're talking about, and Fistful of Metal is more kind of a Judas Priest, a little bit heavy Motorhead type of a vibe. And then you get Joey, and then suddenly you start getting a little bit more thrashy. Was this something like, do you start out saying we want to do something heavier than heavy? Or was it just what you experienced from New York with hardcore and punk? Were you influenced at all by what you were hearing out of the West Coast? How did the sound kind of really form?
The thing about the first record, like when I first came in the band, I think Scott will agree, they had about four or five songs. And then when I came in the band, there was the rest of the songs were written, and it took on a more, I would say, accept meets kind of, you know, Motorhead. And that's the direction. By the time Spreading came along, the whole New York influence, I think, was upon us. And like I said, the last song on that record was to be recorded was AIR. And that was the bridge from that record to Among. Because then that was it. That was the sound, I think, that we all kind of heard. And we all kind of like gravitated to that. That's where we wanted to go. And that's how it happened, really. And then we felt so comfortable. And those songs on Among the Living, especially, man, they were just like, bam, one after another just started to come out, and it just grew into a monster.
I would say, I mean, yes, certainly early on, because there were songs like pre-Fistful, there were other originals that never even made it past, you know, to even Charlie being in the band. There were other songs. There was a song called Satan's Wheels. There was a song called Even Dreams. Yeah, there was.
What's it called?
Hellfire.
Song called, yeah, there was Satan's Wheels. There was a song called Evil Dreams. There was a song. The first original we ever had was a song from Danny that Lilka wrote. That was from his old band, White Heat, and it was a song called Hunting Dogs. I mean, there's demos of this stuff out there, but none of these songs. You know, you quickly start to realize then like a better song gets written and you're like, oh, well, yeah, this is the direction we should be going in. Those other songs they're shit compared to this. And Iron Maiden was certainly in the early days. Right. I mean, it was Maiden and Motorhead and Priest certainly in the early days. Like I'm talking like 82. That was definitely was the biggest, you know, influence on us.
But the thing we don't talk about in this documentary was the song, I think, that really changed the sound of the band was Soldiers of Metal.
Yeah.
It had that kick drum pattern with the guitar.
Triplets.
That was next level for us. So I think that song also was like, there it is. That was the gateway.
That's right. Johnny Z heard it and he said,
By the way,
we're going to put this out on a 7-inch.
It's going to be great.
By the way, it's mega.
Trivia from our friends at Geico, which I think they got from me. Do you know that Anthrax is one of the first bands that Johnny Z ever signed and that Fozzy was the last band Johnny Z ever signed?
Wow.
Really? I didn't know that. Wow.
Full circle there. One of the things that you talk about in the documentary that's very interesting because it's really true is at this time frame in 84, 85, if you're talking about the quote-unquote Big Four, and you can throw in Exodus and all the other bands that were going, all different types of singers. You lose Neil Turbin, you're trying to find a singer, Joey comes in, and suddenly you have something very unique in a very melodic, still ballsy singer, but completely different. Was this a pleasant surprise for you guys? Were you looking for somebody more in the vein of a Tom Araya, or were you just kind of looking for anybody and you found the right guy?
No, from the start, this band has always been, in my mind anyway, my vision for the band was I always wanted a Ronnie. I always wanted a Halford. I always wanted a Bruce. That's how my vision for Anthrax was always having that type of a singer, a singer as our frontman. That's how I've always seen it. So when we were looking for a singer, we were already making Spreading the Disease. And we were looking for a singer. That's what we were looking for. We weren't looking for a shouter or a barker, as much as I love all those types of vocals too. But it, for me, in my brain, that's never what Anthrax was supposed to sound like.
I think collectively, that's how we all felt. As soon as we heard Joey, that was it. It was over. That it just automatically fit. It all made sense after that. And Joey, I'm kissing your ass right now. Enjoy this moment.
I get a few chips in the bucket for that. Thanks, Frank.
No worries.
So, Joey, did you have any idea what thrash metal was, or really heavy metal? I mean, was that something that you were doing, or did you just kind of walk into this a little bit blind?
For me, heavy metal, you know, doing Deep Purple and
yeah, right.
Judas Priest, UFO, Rush, you know, maybe that type of thing, you know, even, I mean, I can't think of heavy stuff at the moment, but I didn't come in there with any kind of perceived notion. And I started hearing their music and I just started singing, and it's like now I just sing. I don't really have any idea in any particular way. It's just, you just start singing, you hear the key, you just roll. And that's basically what I did when I came in. I had no idea. I mean, there really wasn't any kind of instructions when we got there. I just started singing. Even myself, I was like, holy cow, this sounds pretty cool. And it just blossomed from there, you know?
Scott mentions when you joined the band, they wanted to do a little bit of a tour so you could see just what kind of a crowd that they're playing for. Did that kind of blow your mind when you saw, you know, stage diving and moshing and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, the whole thing was, you know, a lot quick, you know, I mean, I think for everybody, I mean, we were pretty surprised to see the craziness, you know, I mean, it really adds to a lot of excitement, but yeah, you had to keep your eyes wide open or you're going to get knocked out, you know, it got pretty crazy, but I had no idea what was coming, you know.
Was that kind of your mindset, Scott, to try and see if he could handle it?
No, not to handle it. It was more so that Joey was going to really start digging into the vocal tracks on the album, and it just seemed like it would be a great idea for him to really experience the energy of what the live show was. And you know, between the five dudes on stage, but also with what was starting to happen with crowds at that point, because that's when the crossover, certainly on the East Coast with metal, like for us, you know, kids were starting a stage dive, there were pits happening at the shows. It was only a few months before that where that wasn't happening at metal shows. So that just started happening. And we're like, what a great idea, man. Let's just go kind of fill the tanks with that energy and then go back in the studio and finish the record.
And also make them feel more of the band, more part of the band. Like we were together already. So get Joey in the band, make them feel like one of us. It was really important.
I don't even remember taking a break and doing that. For some reason, I thought we finished the record and then we went out and played. So I don't remember the break, to be honest with you. I can't even remember. We stopped.
I remember taking a break. We did Armed and Dangerous. Remember we put that out.
Yeah, that came out.
And then we went out and did like 2 weeks of shows. And basically, I think what was on our minds was Joey going to put his fucking suitcase in the dressing room and tell someone, don't touch it. Don't touch it. Yeah. I think that was our thing. You know what I mean? And Joey didn't do that. And it was like, I love this guy. Everybody in the band, everybody knows what I'm talking about.
You gotta know you can get along, right? That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and speaking of getting along, there's something I wanted to ask about. Frankie, when you came in the band, now, you know, you kind of go from like the little nephew, little brother guy who's, you know, the roadie, and now you're in the band, and you guys have been in a band, and your nephew and uncle. Now, Eddie Guerrero, his nephew's Chavo Guerrero, and they're only 3-4 years apart, and they had some of the most horrific fights and then would cry and hug each other afterwards. And then 2 days later, I want to kill you. As you know, I'm sure with the family dynamic with you guys, I'm sure that's been some high spots over the years.
Nothing's ever happened.
Nothing like that ever happened.
I don't know. Charlie and I have both been straight ahead, dude. It's like we shake hands and say, how are you, sir? You know, it's all good stuff.
It's like Frankie's an equal, you know, he fights with everybody, not just me.
Yeah.
Well, I voiced my opinion and I am who I am, you know. And
But it is funny though, like the nephew uncle relationship, when you're really just mostly brothers, it's very, very close in age,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah. We grew up together.
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, Frankie, our friends at Geico ask, did you fit in right away when you joined Anthrax?
Well, I think I fit in before, even because I was with them all the time. You know,
he was already part of
the crew. I love Danny Looker. You know, we had a great time, man. It was just a good hang. We ball busted, dude. That was like high school of ball busting. It didn't stop. And it was just a great time to hang out with friends. They were friends. So, and plus I love the music. So it all worked.
Let's talk about one of the most influential and important gigs in heavy metal history. When you're talking about the Roseland Ballroom, which was Raven, Metallica, Anthrax, and saw all three of the bands get signed to major labels. And keeping in mind at the time, Raven was bigger than probably both of you guys. So what was the vibe like? And was everybody, I guess the idea is, why did all three bands get signed? Was this the place to be for the record executives that night?
Yeah. Yeah, it was similar to what happened with Twisted Sister a few years before that when, you know, they were just, no real labels would even look at them. They were just looked at as this Long Island club band. And then they went and they sold out the Palladium in the city, which was a 3,500 seat venue without a record deal, without any of that. They had their own 7 inches out. And when we sell out Roseland, all three bands on an indie label, 3,500 tickets. Yeah. You know, people's like, huh? Yeah, every A&R, every label had an A&R guy down there that night to see what it was all about. And we didn't know where we were going yet, but I think it was already pretty much known Metallica was going to Elektra already. They had already been talking, and I think Johnny already had the Raven deal at Atlantic pretty much, and we were still like, not that it would have been the worst thing in the world, but like, we want a deal too. We don't want to be just stuck on Megaforce. Come on. What about us?
And NFL draft day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But we had a great show. We had an amazing show that night. And then Island Records started sniffing around. And I do believe we played the Ritz, right? Didn't we do the Ritz in like early 85 with Joey? And then that's when we signed.
The back of the Spreading the Disease, as a group shot of us, that's at the Ritz. That's the night we got signed,
right?
And also happy, like, Island Records was such a great label to be on too. It was so eclectic, you know. They had U2, Bob Marley, and Anthrax.
Yeah.
And it was so amazing. You know,
really unique.
I think exactly, we weren't, you know, in a huge pool of like hard rock and metal. We were the only band, and they really did the work for us. I must say, Island Records busted their balls. I mean, because of them, we have the Not Man, you know?
Mm-hmm. Really? Clear it up for Geico. They came up with the Not Man?
Yeah, it was an ad.
It was an ad, and it said, "By George, I think he's got it." And it said Not. And that was for Spreading the Disease.
And it had the little face. It had the little finger puppet face in the ad.
And they would they would throw him on stage on that tour.
Right.
And it was like, wait a minute. Let's make a shirt, you know? And that's how it all kind of happened. It was such a organic thing that built, you know? It wasn't like some marketing guy was like, it was just amazing, you know?
He won't go away.
Yeah.
And he won't go away.
Well, and along the lines of organic, there's a lot of things that Anthrax kind of pioneered, were the first to do. And the first thing that I noticed was jeans and t-shirts and jean jackets. And here comes Anthrax with the board shorts, the loud shorts. That was the first thing, which then influenced our whole generation of kids, which I think were probably in grade 11 at the time. So it's 16 years old. Everyone's buying the craziest jams, we used to call them. I don't know what you guys called them.
Yeah.
And jams. They'd be these wild colored like shorts, and some of them would be like thigh high where they're way too short, and some of them would be like knee high. But we did that because Anthrax wore those shorts on stage, so suddenly it's cool. You were definitely the first band in heavy metal to do that.
Well, the surf culture in the Bronx and Queens was really big in the early 80s.
The East River, hanging 10 on the East River, amazing.
You go to City Island, and man, it's just the break there is just... That's what I wore all day long. But that, you know, even beforehand, when we were forced to wear a band uniform on the first, like, tour and stuff.
Wait, hold on, a band uniform?
Well, if you see pictures of us from the Fistful tour in 84, you know, we're wearing much like Judas Priest look. We're wearing leather pants and jacket, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, and I get it. I love the way Judas Priest looks, and I love, but there already is that. Like, and I, you know, we were very physical performers, you know, on stage, and it's like, and you're wearing this tight leather and you're weighed down with belts and spikes and chainmail. And it's like, this is just not going to work. So as soon as we were free of that, we just were like, we're just going to wear what we wear. I wear these jams all day long because I skateboard in them. This is what I should just wear. Why do I have to change my clothes to go on stage? It made no sense to me.
Yeah, who didn't want to be comfortable, you know? We just want to be comfortable and have fun.
It was literally how much thought went into that. It's just like, you know, I don't need to change my clothes.
I think, you know, we were the first band to sell baseball hats too.
Really?
And shorts, you know, as merch. Instead of a t-shirt, we would have a baseball hat and shorts.
You wore a baseball hat all the time on stage too.
Yeah.
They were the big wide brim ones too, though, right? And you'd flip up the top and it would say like nod on it or something.
Then I drew on it too. And then Brett Michaels did it. The same thing. You ever see the video?
That's right.
Honestly, God, nobody caught that, I don't think.
But that became the Anthrax gimmick. No one else did that, you know, at the time.
Well, they couldn't, because then they would just look like us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of bands that were starting to look like us, you know, and
after you did it, right?
After we did it, yeah. And then we got a backlash after, like, around State of Euphoria, when people started to like, oh, they look goofy. It's like, all right, whatever, you know.
There was a jam backlash against you guys?
There was.
Yeah.
First they loved
it. They were smiling in photos, and exactly. They embraced it. They loved it. They were looking like that. And then boom. Okay. We brought these guys up, and now let's tear them down. That's exactly. Especially.
I still wore shorts.
Yeah.
We got to do it. So hell with that.
Wait till they see us on these festivals coming up.
Borat bathing suits. Maybe. Is that what you're going to be wearing?
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Dude. Charlie sent a photo today to me and Mike. Yeah, I won't show it now, but I'll text it to everyone.
All right, we're going to talk about I'm the Man, one of the first rock, rap, metal tunes. Before we do, big thanks to Geico for making this special Anthrax 40 episode possible. Do you own or rent your home? If you do, you know it can be hard work. But you know it's easy work? Bundling policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com. So the other thing, of course, well, there's many other things, but another one is when you guys did I'm the Man, which was the first example. Well, I guess you could say maybe a Walk This Way with Run DMC and Aerosmith. But for you guys to do I'm the Man on your own, one of the first kind of rock, rap, metal tunes, did you expect that to be as big of a hit as it was? Because once again, everybody loved that song.
No, it was, there was the expert. Yeah, we figured the best way, the formula to write a platinum selling record is to write the dumbest, stupidest inside joke you could ever think of, take the piss out of yourselves, and then bury it on the B-side of a 12-inch single in the UK.
Yeah, fastest recorded, by the way.
Then you get a platinum record. That's the secret.
no effort in recording that song whatsoever. It's three goofy guys.
Even our vocals on that, when we recorded that, it was during the Among the Living sessions, same, you know, when we recorded it, we did those vocal tracks thinking the Beastie Boys were actually going to be doing it, because we had already talked to them and they said they would be into it. Yes. And so we figured, well, let's at least break up the parts and we'll do it ourselves, and they'll have some type of at least a guide or something, and then they could do whatever the hell they want with it. So when we were even doing those vocals, in my head, I'm just thinking like, well, MCA is just going to do this part anyway. So what do I care?
I did the same thing with Ad Rock. I said, oh, I'll do a high voice like Ad Rock, and he'll sound, and he'll just do it like this. And we just left. It was like more like scratch tracks, really.
I think we did more laughing. We did more laughing during that whole thing than anything.
Yeah. And then because we're not rappers. we're not rappers. We're like, we were just trying to do our best, you know, third rate. I forgot to include something in the magic formula. Make sure that the music, you have to use a Jewish and Italian folk song to rap over. That's the key. You got to have Havanagia and Funiculi Funicula, because that's really the secret sauce right there.
And Rodney Dangerfield.
Yeah.
That's it. Easy money.
That's it. That's where it came from.
I knew that from the start because I used to love that movie when I was a kid. You want some home fries? Give me all my home fries.
Yeah. I mean, Frankie used to do that. Julio, that Taylor Negron, he used to yell that all the time.
Rest his soul. Man.
So like that's where the chorus idea came from. I mean, literally all the lyrics to that are just trying to make ourselves laugh as hard as we can. You know, that's really all it was. There was no expectation. If anything, we thought, well, we love this, but, you know, we're just going to put it out as the B-side in the UK of the I Am The Law 12-inch single, because if people don't like it, it'll disappear pretty quickly. And of course, it was like that snowball rolling downhill. It fucking blew up.
And do you remember we were in Dallas and we recorded that show live
at the Arcadia Theater?
At the Arcadia Theater. And that's what they used for this EP that Island wanted to put out, that I think we were against doing it too.
Right.
Yeah, we did.
Remember that? Yeah. And then we actually did it. And I remember on the Kiss tour, it was out and it was fucking blowing up.
Huge.
And we were like, what the hell is going on? You know? And that thing went on to sell so many records.
Well, remember Donington? I mean, the summer of 87, we do Donington. And, you know, we did I'm the Man in front of 80,000 hard rock heavy metal kids, and they were singing all the words to it. It was crazy.
Pretty incredible.
Crazy.
It was pretty incredible. And the big thing is, like, who knew Joey could fucking play drums so good? And then he would jump back there and he'd start rocking out. And it was like, yeah, I think this is going to work.
And what would you do, Charlie? Just sing?
I was rapping.
Rap.
Yeah, all his parts. And then I was trying to think about this the other day. All those parts like chair and all that, that was from that Letterman bit, right? Wasn't that a thing from like the Letterman show? They would do.
Yes.
The guy. They
Larry
would
Bud. Larry Bud Melman.
Bud Melman.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We better not talk about that too much.
Yeah, we gotta be careful with that.
I will say one more thing about the EP. Thanks to you guys. You guys taught me what the meaning of the word taint is.
Taint.
From your classic song Taint that's on there, which is Taint My Balls, Taint My Ass. What is it?
Yes.
And we had to think about that. Oh, that's what that means.
See, I actually thought that song was going to blow up.
That's the one.
What about
that was actually huge in Lithuania, which you guys don't know. Number one for about a year.
That was the hit.
When you talk about kind of the fun side of the coin, and then you get the serious side of Bring the Noise, and that's another tune that just not only catapulted the band, but also led to one of the best tours that you ever did, one of the monumental kind of genre-crossing tours with Anthrax and Public Enemy. So once I'm the Man becomes a hit, now are you thinking we should do something a little bit more serious in this vein, or was it another organic situation?
No, not yet. Bring the Noise. No, not yet. You know, we were friends with Chuck at that point, 87. Chuck came to see us at the Beacon at the end of 87. I remember him being in the dressing room, and there was a lot of mutual love between the two camps, because I mean, I was wearing a PE shirt on stage all the time, and they name checked us in Bring the Noise on Nation of Millions. So, you know, there was just a lot of mutual respect and love, and they were my favorite band at the time. Like, for me, Chuck's voice was, they moved me the same way Maiden did, and the same way Slayer did, or AC/DC, or I thought Chuck's voice was just the heaviest thing. And still is.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, 88, 89, you know, just that idea of, if there was ever a way to get Chuck's voice and my guitar, I felt like I needed that to happen. I remember thinking about that, like the tone of his voice and the tone of my guitar in a song together would just be so great if that could ever happen. And you know, slowly but surely the whole thing crystallized. And then when we recorded Persistence, it was at the end of those sessions. Charlie had finished drum tracks, and then normally once you're done with the drums, you know how it works, and then the drums get torn down and put away, and it was like, wait, like, you know, stop the clock, don't tear the drums down yet. And then basically Frankie, Charlie, and I went out in the room, and what, we banged out that arrangement in 20-30 minutes probably, and then you tracked it. So, and we knew right then, just with scratch guitar, bass, and the drums, it already was such a monster. Even then we knew, we're like, this is so fucking heavy, like, wait till we get Chuck on this.
And he gets on it, and suddenly once again you have another platinum album,
right? Well, because it's a great track,
right.
I mean,
it's undeniable
how good that is.
It's funny about that record, the Killer Bees, that was the record that crossed over to a different audience. And I remember Frankie and I did this photo shoot with Details with Anthony Kiedis. Remember that?
Yeah.
And Anthony was talking about the Killer Bees, and like, well, I was like, wow. And then other people were talking about it, and that record crossed over. And I always felt that we should have been that band that was on Lollapalooza, you know?
Geico thinks so too.
Because we kind of set that whole thing up, but we didn't get to do that. Like, we were like, oh, they're moving the velvet rope, we're about to go in. And then someone's like, hang on, these guys are metal, push them back, they don't get in, you know? So
we did our own.
We did our own.
Yeah, we did Anthrax, Public Enemy, Primus, and Young Black Teenagers. And if that's not an alternative show, I don't know what is.
It was before Lollapalooza.
Same year, right? First Lollapalooza was 92, so, right?
So we were 91.
91, yeah.
So yeah, we did it. You're right. We actually before it, right?
Yeah.
Ha!
When you guys talked about, you said that, you know, Charlie and Scott and Frankie got together to work on these tracks. I mean, when they brought Chris Slade in this last time to play in AC/DC when Phil couldn't play, Stevie Young, Angus, and Chris worked on their tightness for months before they finally got to the next rehearsal. Did you guys work like that in the early days? Because you're so tight, even to this day, which is probably just instinct by now. But I think Anthrax's rhythm section of the three of you just says this, you know, it's a very AC/DC-esque, but it's obviously a much heavier version. Is that something you guys really worked on, or is it just natural chemistry?
Both. It's a good answer. Yeah.
It's both. Because, I mean, we used to work our asses off back in the day. You know, we were starting from the music building and then to that place in Yonkers. And, you know, in those early days, I mean, it was seven nights a week. Sometimes we were in the room just playing. And then all those early years, you know, when you talk about the making records and touring from, let's say, spreading through Killer Bees, we never stopped album tour, or, you know, like, so you're in the studio making the record, you're working, playing, then you're out on tour for 200 something shows, and then writing, and then right back in the studio. So all those years, I mean, like a decade of basically never stopping. And that just ingrains, you know, they say that 10,000 hours thing. We did 100,000 hours.
No doubt.
But the music building in Jamaica, Queens, we would be there five nights a week sweating as if it was, we're playing this big arena or something like that. And I remember going to, when Joey got in the band, we went to Ronkonkoma, Long Island.
Right. Oh, God.
Yeah.
And remember that? And we played there for like a week or two. And then we did that 2-week run.
At best, yeah.
Remember? And we just worked on our...
Sleeping on the floor.
We slept on the floor.
Yeah.
There's a good story there. But
everybody knows.
Leave it at that.
You'd have to talk to the lead guitar player about that one.
I love these moments. I remember I saw Paul and Ringo have one where they mentioned something about Widow Twanky, and they looked at each other and just started laughing their asses off on Larry King a couple years ago. Something happened there, but we don't need to know. Another thing that was very pioneering between in Anthrax was the fact that Scott and Charlie, it's so ridiculous now, but at the time you guys cut your hair. Like, what? This is a heavy metal band. You have to have long hair and you guys cut your hair. But that became part of the Anthrax. I mean, to this day, the who's the bald guy with the goatee? Oh, that's the Anthrax guy. And then Charlie had the big, long rat tail. What kind of prompted that idea?
Well, there's a thing called male pattern baldness. And I was already losing my hair in the 80s. Like, if you even look at, like, look at the Indians video when I'm headbanging, you see right through that shit.
Right.
And I wanted to shave my head. We were up at Island Records in like 1985 or 86 or something one time. And Billy Milano was with us and I was going to shave my head in the Island Records office bathroom. And then Billy talked me out of it and he shaved not in my chest. But yeah, I had wanted to shave my head forever. I just, you know, it was unfortunate. I started losing my hair early and I didn't want to be that guy. Like holding on to something that was never coming back. I hate it's.
You didn't want to be that. You didn't want to be in Saxon.
Yeah, no comb overs, and there's no comb overs in metal. Actually, there are. That's their problem. So I was like, "Fuck this," and you know, goodbye. Shave it.
But to Scott's credit, he made a whole different image for himself that really worked. So yeah. it's all good.
Well, it's because you did it first. And that's my point. It's like, oh my gosh, this is the first time we've ever seen this, and it works.
I know, fucking bald metal.
You know, we were finishing the Clash of the Titans tour and I was going to do it on that tour and I didn't do it. I waited till we finished it and then I cut my hair because I didn't like it. Just never liked it. Didn't like it. And I just felt the day I did it, man, I just felt so relieved. And that was it. I felt like a different person.
Was the rat tail just because Neil Peart had one for a while?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
That's it. That's why.
Oh, there's another Widow Twanky, another private joke. One of the best moments from Anthrax, because you guys mentioned you're smiling, you have great personalities. I just saw it a couple weeks ago is your appearance on Married with Children, which is legit funny. It's not one of these stunt castings where the guys are kind of like, you know, like Wayne Gretzky on Saturday Night Live where he can't act and it's very stone delivery. It's really funny. Once again, one of the like classic moments in Anthrax's career.
Yeah.
Yeah, it gets talked about all the time. I mean, I can't believe how much people talk about it.
Yeah, that I think about that week. I mean, that's one of those things that I think about it a lot, you know, like it'll just pop because, you know, Married with Children pops up or you see Ed O'Neill or Katie Sagal. I just heard her on something and, you know, you see Christina Applegate. You see these people. So that boom, the memory comes back and. And it's a great memory. It was an unbelievable week, just unbelievable.
The story about it is originally we were pitched for The Simpsons and The Simpsons had already had their seasons all done, the season all done. So it got passed around and then the producers of Married with Children wrote this episode around us. And that's how it happened. And I'll never forget the first day we're at the table read and we're all sitting there and like, what the fuck, you know? Like all these people are sitting around us from the show and it was crazy. And we took a break and went outside and there's Tony Danza.
Yeah.
Just right there. You remember that?
Yeah. Who's the Boss was right next door.
It was so surreal, man.
That was surreal. Nuts. And it was great just hearing at that table read, just watching like Ed O'Neill do his lines with Katie and, you know, going over stuff and the laughs right there. What didn't work, what worked. That was so much fun, man. And we were just like kids in the candy stores. Yeah, this is awesome, you know? It's great.
Yeah, we were all fans of that show, you know? So, and we had met them before. We got to play in one of those
softball
KNAC softball game. Or
it was TJ Martell.
Right.
TJ Martell.
So we had met them, but, you know, we never really hang out with them. But yeah, and then suddenly you're in their bubble, like in their world. And I mean, I got to admit, I was super nervous. You're sitting there at the table and I'm like seeing like, oh, my God, my line's coming up. You know, like just you want to do a good job. You don't want to hold people up. But everyone was so nice.
Yeah. And like, they even changed the lines on us, too, a lot. So you couldn't really get set in your way. Right.
And Ed O'Neill would pull you aside. Like I remember one time he pulled me aside and he said, you know what? Say it like this with the inflection here. And then he would do it. And you go, try it like that. It might feel more natural. And I try it and be like, oh, thank you so much. You know, like it's just he was so cool.
So the last day was Friday when they taped two shows. and they taped an early evening one, and then there's one about an hour after that. So we did the first one. We thought we did so great, and then they changed our lines for the next show.
Yeah,
and it was like, oh no! What
we only had a couple of hours to learn our new lines and stuff like that. It kind of changed everything that was going on. I was going, really? It worked.
But it was way better. The second one was way better.
Totally, they were right about it. Totally.
There was one part of that. There was a part in the script where I was so happy that it was me, where Kelly decides she's going to sleep with one of us. And it turned out that just so happened it was me. And there was a part in the script where, and we even rehearsed it on the set, where she takes me by the hand and we'd walk up the stairs to go to the bedrooms. Of course, there's no bedrooms up there. Yeah. You go through that doorway, there's nothing back there. But, When I found out that was happening, I mean, my head was exploding because, you know, wait till all my friends see this. You know, I mean, Married with Children was such a big show. And it's like, and I'm going upstairs to have sex with Kelly Bundy, right? In fake TV world. Right. That's amazing, right? So cut to on the Thursday, we're at the read, and that whole thing is not in there. And I went over to one of the producers and I said, what happened to the scene where I go upstairs with Christina? And he said, yeah, she came in the office last night. And she was like, yeah, about that scene where I go upstairs with Scott. She's like, you know, I know my character's a slut, but she's not that much of a slut. Come on. Pull the rug out from under me.
Another thing I love about it too, it's like Anthrax meets the Phantom of the Park. Super thick New York accents. The colors. If it's in the fridge, why is it warm?
You can't take that out, man. It ain't gonna happen.
Pearl still busts my balls. Every once in a while, I'll happen to say something about it. She goes, the colors.
Let's talk about some of the tours that you guys had then, because you had some great ones. Are there some that stand out for you, like, you know, touring with your heroes or touring with other bands that you didn't know as much about?
There's so many.
Maiden. I mean, come on, to this day. And you guys have had a great relationship with Maiden all the way up to, you know, 2019. I think you guys got to ride on the plane over there with them.
I was in 16. 16? Right? Somewhere 17. I can't remember. But
imagine that already. It's that long. God.
We did a whole Mexico, Latin America, South America run on the 747, which I'd have to say as an touring experience, that for me that's the biggest, best, craziest thing ever. I mean,
I agree.
That's just something, unless Maiden decides to do it again, it will never, we'll never be on our own 747 again, you know, for a month. Right. And they carried all our gear, you know.
Remember the first day we get on there and we're sitting like in first class. That's where we are. The band is upstairs. Maiden are upstairs. And the flight attendants come out and what would you like to drink? And we're like, oh, this is awesome. And then they have the Iron Maiden napkins and cups. You know, it was just so crazy, man. Loved it. And I will say this, Bruce Dickinson flying the plane was better than the other pilot. Oh, yeah. Bruce was smooth.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was awesome.
Remember that time came down and we swung around real quick? Oh,
that was Chile. Chile.
That was wild.
That's where the plane got hit, remember?
Yeah. Oh, on the runway, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we've done a lot. I mean, any Maiden tour, but specifically that one, you know, what an unbelievable experience. And then besides just flying around on a plane with them and Bruce Dickinson flying you, we got to play stadiums all over with Iron Maiden. So we'd play these to the best metal audiences in the world. So we would have these amazing shows and then we'd get to watch Maiden play to those audiences. So everything about it was just, fantastic.
Remember the police escorts we had?
Yeah. Police escorts.
We would come through and the place was shut down until we got to the hotel. It was freaky.
Do you remember El Salvador?
Uh-huh.
Remember the El Salvador? So we played the show there. And then the next day, I think who came to see us was like the vice president.
Yeah. Maiden
and all of us and the crew and he met us in the lobby because we were about to go to the next country. And he's like, I wanted to come down and thank you. He said, yesterday in El Salvador, there was no crime because all the criminals were at your show. We're like, ah! It's so funny, man.
They've always been a class act from, and they showed us how to treat bands. They were always great from the beginning with us. So, you know, again, just a little thing at the end of that tour was special for me. Everybody flew home. They were flying to New York. So I was lucky enough to be able to fly home with them. They asked me on the maiden to JFK, dude. So that's a big deal for me. So I'm sitting in my first class seat, which is incredible because I'm, you know, spoiled at this point. I'm psyched as hell. So I get a tap from one of the flight attendants. Bruce would like to see you upstairs. No, I'm not going upstairs. I'm afraid, you know, I've never been in a cockpit. I'm not going up there. You know, you should go. You know, you should go. I'd rather not. He goes, Bruce is insisting you're up there. So I go up there, man. I don't know if you've ever been in a cockpit. I'm freaked out with all that stuff coming at me.
Right.
I get in there. Apparently, he was looking for some flight pattern to come into JFK that he couldn't find. So him and the co-pilot were just throwing papers around everywhere. And there's like literally papers everywhere. So he looks back at me. He goes, oh, great time to come, Frank. You know, I'm like, oh. And all of a sudden, I felt really ready. So I sit back. They finally found one. And then he does a couple of nice turns for me just to scare the shit out of me. It was fucking awesome. Dude, we got in there. I go right through. I live in New York all my life. Customs in JFK is not the easiest place, right? When you go in, I went with the maiden pass, dude. Nobody stopped me. I went right through. It was class act all through, man. I loved it.
We had that whole trip too. Remember, every time we went somewhere, we could go in and out like nothing happened.
Yeah.
Or we're having breakfast with Bruce with his suit on in the morning.
Yep.
Yeah.
Ready to take off to prepare for his flight.
You know, we have to mention too, as specifically as a New York band, when we headlined Madison Square Garden in 91 on Clash of the Titans, and then of course also playing Yankee Stadium on the Big Four, like those stand out to me too as two moments that are, as you know, for me, you know,
that's huge.
For Anthrax, you know, because with Maiden, yeah, we were the support, and it's always amazing to be with them. But you know, for us. Well, we didn't headline Yankee Stadium, but you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Getting to play Yankee Stadium as part of the Big Four also was, you know, for me, what's bigger or better than that? It's just mind-blowing.
How important were the Big Four shows? Because it was massive, and as Geico points out, a monumental moment for heavy metal fans.
Not enough shows.
Yeah, we wish, you know, of course, everyone was hoping for more. And hey, who knows? Someday. You know, but it was great. It was great for us. It was such perfect timing for us with, you know, worship music coming and like literally worship music coming out the week we played Yankee Stadium. You know, it was just it was such a great launch pad for us again. And really, like, we haven't looked back since, you know, 2010, 2011, when we were doing those shows. And they were amazing. And you could obviously, for the fans, it was because, you know, the business those shows did. You know, it's something that people are really excited about, and it created a lot of excitement, and there was a lot of energy around it. I think all the bands on it were happy to be there, and everybody was getting along, and you know, it was really great. And Metallica, again, also much like Maiden in that way, really went above and beyond to make sure everybody was taken care of and did the right thing by everybody on every possible level. It was just such a great thing.
Even the Clash of the Titans, the Ozzy tour, the Kiss tour, those are really great too. I mean, man, talk about awesome.
When you do these big shows with Metallica, you know, the stadium, and considering you guys started out the exact same way, you know, you 1983, 84 with Johnny Z at the, you know, Rock and Roll Heaven and puking on each other at the record store and all those stories. When you see them now, is it still like that, or is there a little bit of like, oh, they're Metallica now, or is it still the same old dudes and it's all cool?
I just saw Kirk a couple of weeks ago. We're the same two idiots we were in 1983. Yeah,
that's awesome.
Totally.
I'm happy for my friends. The way I look at it, Metallica is like a phenomenon of our time,
right?
Really, music. So I love that. Yeah, we all started together, but I love to see that happened. You know, for one of us, I call it one of us. So,
well, they are, yeah.
So I just think it's a great thing to see that our music, our type of music, became this big stadium thing, right? How great is that? It's an amazing thing that happened. And I'm glad one of us got to that status. It's awesome. So the rest of us will play with you. Great. I'll do another Big Four right now. that was a great experience. That was fun.
Johnny Zio is used to say back in the early days, like when Metallica was going out with Raven, yeah, they were opening for Raven in the summer of 83. And we'd be like, oh my God, you know, what an amazing thing to be able to go out on a tour. And he's like, you'll get there. You're only 6 months behind them. Right. I think about that sometimes now, like, are we still, is that still 6 months from now? We'll be.
Think about that too.
You guys, once again, as we start to wind down here, 40 years of being one of the biggest bands in heavy metal. And like Scott just said, after the big four with Worship Music and Four All Kings and lots of momentum, it really is at the point, especially now that we're finally getting past this pandemic, that it seems that in a lot of ways Anthrax is bigger than ever. Would you guys agree with that?
No, I think we should take 5 years off and then come back and then we'll be even bigger. You know, that's a pet peeve of mine. But anyway, I think that we're definitely different. We're so educated now on how to do things that, like, when we go, we're going to do these festivals coming up and we're definitely going to step it up, you know, with the show, because I see in the past 3 years, a lot of bands have stepped up the show. And that's one thing that we want to do is do that, you know, bring a bigger show to the fans.
It's what we did in the 80s. You know, we looked at Maiden and bands like that. Every year you'd come back with a new stage set, you know, and so that's what we started doing. And then at some point we stopped doing that. And it's like, kind of like, well, maybe it's time to start doing that again.
Makes sense. It's for the fans, man. Bottom line.
Well, I mean, it's interesting too, because like we said, as you get older too, you kind of know, like when you're younger, like I had this with some of the guys that I work with back in the past, you know, you're busting each other's balls and this guy's a fucking asshole and fuck him. And as you get older, you realize, like, why did we argue so much? Like, just give each other a little bit of extra space. And do you find that as you grow older as a band, that you know each other's boundaries and you're better because of it?
You have to do it. You know, you gotta see what people are feeling out and how their lives are going, you know?
Yeah. I mean, look, with maturity and stuff, you'd hope, or with maturity comes maturity, you would hope, right? I think you really need to, a lot of that stuff needs to be addressed, I think, when you're younger and you're in the thick of it back then, because, you know, that's when it's the most difficult. And if you could get through that, you know, that's why you don't see a lot of bands. That's why bands break up, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And if you can't have hard conversations sometimes, and if you can't really address those things when you are younger, you'll never make it to being in a band when you're older.
For instance, nowadays, if you come to our show, two things, you'll get one night or the other night. If you come to a show and we're backstage, you may see the four, five of us in corners, like talking to our families or whoever, you know, and then there'll be other nights when somebody will come to the show and you'll have something afterwards and you kind of blow it up. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just, we still enjoy that, you know, blowing it up some nights, you know, but then there's other nights where it's just kind of, it's mellow, you know?
Of course. Question from Geico. Will you do some kind of a 40th anniversary tour or anything like that once you guys can go back on tour?
I don't think so, because, you know,
we're doing the
live stream, you know, to kind of commemorate it, to cap off this whole buildup of the documentary series, you know, and certainly at least revel in the occasion. I'll certainly be raising a glass on July.
I get it.
On July 18th.
He's going to be in the band soon enough.
Yeah, really. Yeah, you know, look, we have a lot of one-offs this year, festivals, and then going into 22, certainly the hope is a new record and then get back to it. We'll be back out there touring again for real if the world allows, you know, next year. And will we brand that a 40th anniversary? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. It's something that we need to do because it's already passed. We'll save it for 50.
You got the live stream coming up. Are you going to do some stuff that that you haven't done in a while?
No, the fans don't want it.
They never ask us that.
You put up a list of songs of all your tracks and you ask the people to vote in, and it happens every time. The top 20 songs are the 20 songs you play all the time.
So, and they get half people mad about them. You're still playing the same songs. Look, I love the change. This whole demographic wants this. So it's tough.
It's right. When we were doing the Among the Living show a couple of years ago, where we were playing the whole record, we quickly realized, first of all, I think it was Charlie who said, we can't play it in sequence order. It's yeah. really not working, because that record, the sequence of that record, it goes what? Among, Caught, I Am the Law, like NFL, Skeleton in the Closet, Indians. Right? It's like six in a row of big songs that, you know, like big Anthrax songs. And then it goes to like One World, which we hardly, we hardly ever did that song live. And then Horror of It All, and then Imitation of Life. So after Indians, it would literally go from here and then crickets.
Right.
For the last three songs. Like, it's like people never heard those three songs. Like, we were literally like we were playing new songs. And so we changed the order. So we weren't like sliding down a slope for the last 15 minutes of the set. And that just really shows you, too, like people would go nuts for those first six songs. And then they get to something that they weren't as familiar with. And literally the fucking energy went very strange.
It's like when Metallica did the Black Album in its entirety, they started from the last song and went all the way back to Enter Sandman for right. that same reason.
The live stream, where we are playing different yeah. songs. We're yeah, not, yeah. not we playing are. The same.
I know, I was being sarcastic.
Yeah, we'll play some songs off of Fistful too, you know? So looking forward to it.
Last question for you guys. What's your, I guess, not to sound too Oprah, but what's kind of like your last thought about the last 40 years of Anthrax, your overall feeling of this huge part of your life, and what's your favorite Anthrax record that's not Among the Living? You want to start, Charlie?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing, the first thing that comes to my mind is kind of like family. Like, everybody's kind of like family. I see these guys more than I saw my family, you know. During the years, during our adult life, we spent pretty much a lot of time together. So if I don't see them in a long time, and then when I see them, it's kind of like, oh, here's what I've been doing. And then we all start kind of talking, like, and then we start laughing. And then and then that finishes, and then we're back to, I see you. We got to go. Yeah. No, but it's like, I think of that a lot. And I actually think about Spreading the Disease more, because that was the word. Record where I think we became that band, you know.
Geico says you're next, Joey. Your thoughts?
Well, I guess it's just the overall, just being a musician and being able to stick with it and be always on the up and up, you know. Just do what you need to do and be a good band guy, you know. Whatever it is that you got to do to be in a band, and just take it and all the success that we've had. And I'm really happy about that. It makes you just feel good about what you've achieved. You know, again, it's same thing with Charlie said, spreading, because that's where it all happened for me, where everything just kind of, I plugged in and here we went, you know, and it was, that was that.
Frankie.
It's crazy. You know, 40 years in, you say, and these albums are more like scrapbooks of your life. If you look at them the way they are, and you remember the times, the touring, the great times and recording, all that stuff, all the whole ride, I enjoy the ride. And the ride, funny enough, and you go to records, I like what we're doing now for All Kings. So I leave it there. For me, it makes a lot of sense where we're on right now and to see what we're up to next. So always going, I like the mystique that Anthrax has, because you don't know where we're going. I love that about the energy. It's an energy that we have. You don't know what we're going to come up with. You know it's going to be quality, but I'm excited not only as the band member, but a fan. I think that's really important.
Scott?
I was fixing the light in here because it was still is. I'm giving me like these crazy, looks like these angry eyebrows.
Dude, I thought you just did some new makeup thing. It looked good.
Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, what was the first part of the question?
Just what's your kind of your overall thoughts about Anthrax 40 years later? Mr. Lugosi.
I'm just looking at his eyebrows now, dude.
It's crazy. I don't know what's doing now.
Play the devil.
Do it without my glasses. Oh, no. Yeah,
there you go. He's
doing this kind of thing.
I love the fact that we've been able to do whatever we've wanted to do. Always. It's just always been our band. It's just, we've done it our way. In a lot of ways, it just really plays to my kind of blue collar work ethic of getting up in the morning and going to work. It's not something I've ever had a problem with. And I love the fact that this has been what I've gotten to do for all of these years, all these decades. Like, that this is what I get to do. And, you know, the joy, I think that even if it's not like something I'm constantly thinking about or, you know, ruminating on, but I know how happy this has made me in my life, because, you know, I'm generally a very happy person. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that this is what I've gotten to do all these years, and it's all I ever wanted to do. And they say that keeps you young. So fingers crossed.
Favorite album that's not against the Among the Living?
It's tough. My gut instantly was Worship Music, but then I started thinking about Persistence too. And there's just, I don't know, something about that record. I revisited it not that long ago and was like really listening to it for the first time in a long time. And yeah, man, there's some fucking great songs on that record, like really heavy. And I don't even remember writing some of those lyrics. I was like, wow, I wrote that. Like, wow, you know, that's pretty cool. And it would be one of those two, I guess, Persistence or Worship.
Well, it's great to do this with you guys. And congratulations on 40 years. I've been a huge Anthrax fan. Winnipeg was always a big Anthrax city, even more than the other two big fours besides Metallica. So to be sitting here with you guys is very cool for me as a fan and as a friend as well. And as a peer, because we did sell out Kufstein.
We sold out Kufstein.
Which was huge. I mean, there's the Budokan and there's the Garden and there's Kufstein. So we'll always have that.
We are huge in Kufstein.
Right.
Thank you, guys. I look forward to seeing you on the road somewhere soon.
You too.
Right on.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Chris. Cheers.
You can ride on our bus any day, Fozzie. Remember you got stuck with your toothbrush and no clothes?
I did, yeah. We were stuck. We had a little bit of an accident, and I got stuck with you guys in Denmark, yeah?
Yeah.
With my toothbrush. Scott wasn't there. That's when Andreas Kisser showed us how to make a bong with an apple.
Yeah.
Yep. Good times.
That's good. I had to bring that up. That was too funny.
And don't forget, and this includes you, Geico, check out the Anthrax 40 live streaming event this Friday, July 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern. Tickets and the show are available at anthraxlive.com.